This is the rehearsal of the speech to the Mountains and Plains Library Association in Aspen in early October. Like light, time is both wave and particle. Even as the big winter of our life, or some summer of dazzle and love, traces itself as a single amplitude of season along the collective dateline of memory, simultaneously, it stipples all through us in instants distinct as the burn of sparks. Writers, whether it is because we have a naturally biblical inclination, the book of Job, man is born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward, or just because we like to play with fire, writers tend to be spark catchers. Somewhere there, then, in the private pivots of history, in the flyways of sparks from which lives are constellated, let me take you now. The next words are from the spring of 1945, from a rooming house in Wickenburg, Arizona. My mother is writing to her brother on a destroyer in the South Pacific that last spring of World War II. She and my father and I have spent that winter in Arizona, where my father worked in a Phoenix defense plant while they tried to see whether the Southwest climate might mitigate my mother's asthma, which had plagued her throughout the 31 years of her Montana life. I am on the scene now, at least marginally, as a five-year-old who has spent that Phoenix winter digging a foxhole in the backyard that, in the words of my mother's letter, you could bury a cow in. There in Wickenburg, where we had a lit while my father recuperated from an emergency appendicitis operation, Montana is on our minds. On the 18th of March, my mother writes, "We are getting kind of anxious to get home, see everybody, find out how I'm going to feel, figure out what we are going to do this summer." Home. What can account for my mother's automatic use of that word, for going back to that drafty northern attic of the West where we came from? Montana's Big Belt Mountains, hard scrabble ranch country near 16 Mile Creek, where sour winter customarily stayed on past the high school spring prom. I have stared holes into those Big Belt Mountains, those sage scrub flats and bald 16 hills, trying to savvy their hold on her, and thus on us, my father and me, particularly there in severe 1945. True, in Phoenix we had been war loyally putting up with packing crate living conditions along with 5,500 other people in a defense housing project across the street from the Alcoa plant. But lately at Alcoa, the management had realized how rare were undraftable, colorblind 43-year-olds who knew how to run a crew. My father came zinging home from the plant, newly made a foreman. Not only that, but drawing hourly wages. Hourly, for a guy who counted himself lucky to make any money by the month in Montana ranch work. Surely this, the state of Arizona humming and buzzing with defense plants and military bases installed for the war. This must be the craved new world, the shores of Social Security and the sugar trees of overtime. Montana, meanwhile, was being drained of people into military service or the shipyards of the coast or defense plants, wherever. The railroad village of Ringling, where my mother grew up, was waning into whatever is less than a village. The county seat of White Sulphur Springs had been handled roughly by the Depression and the war, sagging ever farther from its original dream of becoming a thermal spring resort. Out around in the Smith River Valley, the big absentee owners still owned ranches, and we didn't. My father's birthright, the Doig homestead, had fallen from family hands long ago. Looked at clinically, there was not much to come back to in Montana after half a century of my parents and their parents hurling themselves at those hills. Nor, in fact, did that yearning north toward home end well. Because when my parents returned to Montana and took a band of sheep into the Bridger Mountains, that summer my mother died of her asthma there at the sheep camp. And so I'm left to wonder. My parents, landless people of the relic world of muscle-driven rural tasks, and both my mother and father in shaky health, they turned their back on Arizona and a Sunbelt life there in that spring of 1945. Yet, why did they? I can only think that it was because earth and heart don't have much of a membrane between them. Sometimes decided on grounds as elusive as that single transposable H, this matter of sighting ourselves, of a place mysteriously insisting itself into us. The saying in our family for possessing plenty of something was that we had oceans of it. And in her final report from the desert to her sailor brother in the Pacific, my mother provided oceans of reasons why we were struggling back north to precisely what we had abandoned. One adios to Arizona she spoke was economic. So few possibilities for people with a limited supply of money like ourselves to get anywhere in any kind of business. She saw corporate Phoenix and land-vending Wickenburg plain. It might be better after the war, but I think it will be worse. And the contours of community were beckoning us. We don't just like the idea of being way down here and all our folks in Montana. Valid enough in itself, that need for people and places, friends and family, with well-trodden routes of behavior. Home is where, when you gossip there, any hearer knows the who, what, why. Yet, there was unwordable territory, too, in our return to what my mother's letters all of that Arizona winter insist on as home. Refusal to become new atomized Americans, Sunbelt suburbanites, and instead going back to a season-cogged ranch life is one thing. Going back specifically to the rough-cut Big Belt Mountains, the tough 16 country, the Montana way of life where we could never quite dodge our own dust, all that is quite another. My parents can only have made such a choice from their bottommost natures, moods deep and inscrutable as the keels of icebergs. That's the thing about writers, though. We can't help scrutinizing even the inscrutable. So, as the product of people who, even when a war and bad health tried to make them move away, were permanently wed to their heart-deep version of the West, married to the place, as my folks used to say of a ranch that was particularly hard to get away from. I'd like to give you, as keepers of the West's books, some idea of the makings of those books, of how at least some of us as writers, Western-born, others, fervent adoptees of the region, try to get these mountains and plains and their stories and characters to speak up in our pages. They call it regional, this relevance, the deepest place we have. In this pool forms a model of our land, a lonely one, responsive to the wind. Everything we own has brought us here. From here we speak. That poem, Lake Chelan, by William Stafford, I think reminds us that the West is delineated by more than state lines and survey lines and property lines. Lines of poetry and lines of prose also mark out for us this deepest place we have. The strongest of poetry and storytelling comes right up off the page into our lives, and I want to move for the next several minutes to some instances of what, in the new book, Hard Earth, I didn't know what to call except the slow poetry of fact. Writers get paid, at least once in a while, not to think in absolutely straight lines. So I'm going to argue to you that even when the best of today's American Western writing happens to be in prose and fiction, it still arises out of that slow poetry of fact, out of particles more than wave, out of the arithmetic of particulars, which creatively gets added up into story. The best description of stories as handled by writers that I've ever been able to come up with is simply the one by the poet Randall Jarrell, whose poem, The Woman at the Washington Zoo, where the women in saris go by me from the embassies, cloth from the moon, cloth from another planet, they look back at the leopard like the leopard, I think is itself a magnificently done story. Randall Jarrell said, a story is a chain of events. Since the stories that we know are told by humans, the events of the story happen to human or anthropomorphic beings, gods, beasts, and devils, and are related in such a way that the story seems to begin at one place and to end at a very different place without any essential interruption to its progress. The poet or storyteller, so to speak, writes numbers on a blackboard, draws a line under them, and adds them into their true but unsuspected sum. For the writer, and therefore we hope for the reader, there's creative magic and unsuspected sum, waiting within such actualities as James Welch's fact of the historic Blackfeet, believing animals sometimes spoke to them, out of which Jim made perhaps the greatest leap any of us of this writing generation out here are going to make toward the soul of a people, when in his novel Fool's Crow, he has the non-human creatures of their cosmos speaking to his Blackfeet characters. Mary Claremont Blew, in her fine set of memoir essays, All But the Waltz, captures for all of us who've ever had any strange fact in our family as we grew up, the powerful difficulty she had as a child trying to explain to her schoolmates the unnuptialed presence of her grandmother's boyfriend. Bill Kittredge has given us, in Hole in the Sky, the bravely illustrative fact of his baronial Oregon family rising and falling in a classic three generations, trying to manage our ranch lands with efficiency we thought of as scientific, but our actual model was industrial, thereby killing the country they loved. More prosaically, let me take you briefly through this writerly process of the poetry of fact accumulating itself, using an example I know best, my own. Among the countless colored coats that fact can wear, this particular time it was dressed old-fashioned, black and white and red all over, that old pun about newspapers before they were such a threatened species. The accumulated 90 years of the weekly newspaper of Shoto, Montana, the Shoto Acantha, actually are in red protective binders in the public library there in Shoto. And so, this becomes a Thursday, the evening the Shoto Public Library stays open past supper time. And I am at a table on the library's small mezzanine, going through old newsprint to try to hear into that area of Montana during the Depression years, the drought years. In mid-February of 1939, the homespun local columnist reports that there had been a heavy fog, unusual to that climate and time of year. A stirring begins on the library stairs, and up comes a group of women from a Hutterite colony near Shoto. In their long skirts, patterned aprons, and kerchiefs, they might have just stepped out of the pages of Tolstoy. I think of Paul Horgan, who, when he got tired of being called a Southwestern writer, said that artists in all forms have always paid homage to their home territory. "Everybody is a regionalist," Horgan said. "Tolstoy is a regionalist." I open the next red binder. The columnist is saying in the issue of May 18, 1939, "If the adage of rain 90 days after a fog holds good, a heavy soaking rain will come on the 21st. Steps on the mezzanine stairs again. A ranch wife appears and begins browsing forcefully through the fiction shelves. No nonsense about her as she flips open novels and takes or rejects them on the basis of their opening sentence. I reopen the red binder to the next week's newspaper, May 25th, 1939. Which reports that a downpour started in the early morning of the 22nd. It went on all through the day and into the night, an inch and two-thirds of rain before it quit. Opportune for the crops, the homespun columnist states with satisfaction of that fog forecast goose drowner. And I sit, thinking of all the rain that must have seemed like after the years of drought. The land suddenly swimming with valuable moisture, and more of it coming as May went off the calendar wetly. Steps on the stairs. It is the volunteer evening librarian telling me apologetically that she has to close up now. I close the red binder on the 1939 newspapers, go out into the summer night. A couple of years later, when my novel about Montana during the Depression years, English Creek, is published, a forceful woman named Beth McCaskill shows up almost immediately. And the book's opening sentence reads, "That month of June swam into the Two Medicine Country." Fact, I'm glad to say, also goes out to eat and drink. And here in the West, that sometimes can be especially slow and poetic. There is a delicious hunger of the ear behind stories, either the hearing of them or the telling of them. And I spend a lot of time simply following the sound of voices. It begins at breakfast in Shoto, Montana, or Cortez, Colorado, or Richfield, Utah, when the guys in tractor caps take over their usual table and start drinking coffee and solving the world's problems. Folklorists actually have a term for those caffeine circles. They call them the big table. I've always just called them the geezer table. But in any case, those gatherings over morning coffee or 4th of July rodeo picnic potato salad or afternoon or evening imbibings in bars usually called the Stockman or the Mint are a rhythm of the West that I, at least, believe is worth some listening to. Something must account for this kind of example. A bit of dialogue in my novel, Ride With Me, Mariah Montana, overheard between two Ole drinkers in the Hoopa bar in Shelby in the book. "Tell you, Ron, I don't know what you got going with Barbara Joe, but don't let her get you in front of no minister. This marriage stuff is really crappy. You take, Jeannie's mom is always on my back about why don't we come over more. But we go over there and the stuff she cooks, she never salts anything or anything. I don't eat that crap without no salt on it." Last time she called up and asked Jeannie why we weren't coming over, I told Jeannie to tell her I had to lay down and rest. Then there's Jeannie's dad. He just got dried out down at Great Falls. Cranky old son of a bitch. I think I ought to give him a few beers so he wouldn't be so much of a craphead is what I think. And you know what else? Jeannie's brother and sister-in-law had a 4th of July picnic and didn't even invite us. That's the kind of people they are. Jeannie and I have been talking a lot lately. I told her I about had it with her crappy family. Soon as the first of the year and I get enough money ahead to buy my big bike, I'm heading out to the coast and go to school somewhere. Yeah? Ron responded. What in? Social work. In this particular case, that swatch of bar talk was about half overheard, including, I swear on an oral history manual, that punchline, and half made up by me. The made-up half has in it the trace elements of fact that weren't there for me simply as an eavesdropper, folklorist, oral historian, reporter, whatever. The echo of Exodus, our incipient social worker's dream of heading out to the coast. This is part of the job description of the writer, I think, letting other voices speak the situation. Thus we get such accuracies as the line in Wallace Stegner's story, Carrion Spring. The young ranchman, who modernly might be described as suffering a lack of communication with the young wife he has brought to the prairies of Saskatchewan, but who, when they meet up with the hard-used son of the local wolf hunter, can say to the boy the perfect pitch sentence, "How have you been doing on wolves?" To me, there is simply a perfectly written Western ethic, a rightness of sound. I can hear any number of Westerners I've ever known coming out with this sentence, in the unbeatable line that Bill Kittredge wrote in his short story, Balancing the Water, where he had a ranch hand say, "All you can own is what you do." By the same token, small talk with a lot big behind it, from Marie Sandoz, early in Old Jewels, we take in a lasting intimation when a ranch cook cracks to the young Swiss homesteader about his chosen Nebraska earth. Great farming country. Never get your crops wet there. In these ways, the West as heart earth is given some of its existence by writers, the literary community, let's say. But it also exists in a community honeycombed in your libraries. The community of facts, waiting to give us their slow poetry. Like it or don't, the past and the present that keeps enlisting in it amounts to more than our personal sums. We have a collective memory, we really do, sometimes in spite of ourselves. And much of it, as you maybe too well know, ends up on your shelves. I'm honestly not going to dwell on Doig's law to you, that the more obscure a holding seems to a librarian, the more valuable it is to me as a writer. But I do need to tell you that your stashes of old newspapers and dust-gathering volumes of local histories and other shelving headaches are part of the arithmetic of particulars from which our stories get told. Call it more than that, in fact. Go into French and call it annal, the mosaic type of historiography that has brought forth masterworks such as Emmanuel Leroy Lagerie's recreation of a 14th century village, Montalieu. It is not inconceivable, given the American West's lengthening strands of cultural geography, folklore, literary narrative, archival enterprise, and historical insight, that we are going to see Western Montalieus woven. Shelby, Montana, and Little American Wyoming, and any number of our other Western map dots, we may not generally think of as candidates to become a classic. And yet, to put it in one of the Montanan terms my tongue still has the habit of, just why the hell not? Along these lines, we writers sometimes owe you keepers of the materials for some odd stanzas of library endeavor, as well as your usual rhyme and reason. I like the heroic story of the files of the WPA Federal Writers Project for Montana. During the 1930s, as part of that New Deal project, which also produced the famous state guidebooks, as you know, local people were put to work gathering local lore, often from their neighbors, sometimes even from themselves. In Montana, that gathering was done in every county, the material accumulated. Files of it ended up at the State Historical Society in Helena. But a day in 1943, a history professor from Montana State College in Bozeman, Merrill Burlingame, decided to ride along with another faculty member on a trip to Butte, where the other faculty member needed to look at some sort of river and stream study that had ended up in the warehouse of the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, which was phasing out of existence. As Merrill Burlingame told the story when I asked him for it, we found the files we wanted near the loading door, even closer to the loading dock door, were 6 or 8 file cases marked Writer's Project. I investigated ever so lightly and began to drool. At that moment, the woman in charge appeared. We questioned her about the destination of these files. She informed us that they would go to the Butte City dump in the morning. We backed her into whatever corner was available and told her she could not do that. She assured us in unprintable but perfectly clear English that she could and would. She told us that in an early stage of closing the records, she had sent a portion of these Writer's Project records to the Montana Historical Society, which was the approved depository. There, numerous writers of sorts, largely of the newspaper variety, had used generous portions of the materials without giving the WPA the least credit. She didn't approve of that, and she would make sure that the Historical Society did not get one more folder of those records. The dump loomed. Burlingame goes on. We assured the good lady that nothing of that kind would happen at Montana State College, and that we would take special care that the WPA did get credit. About 4:30, we got her permission to take them, but we were sure that speed was of the essence. We telephoned the college physical plant office and pressured them to provide a truck and driver in Butte as early as possible the following morning. And at that early hour, I came back with the driver. I, as another writer of sorts, am eternally thankful that Merrill Burlingame did. Nearly 40 years later, when I was getting underway on that novel set in Montana in the 1930s, in I came to the special collections at Montana State University Library and merrily ransacked those invaluable first-hand accounts of life during the Depression that Merrill Burlingame heroically saved from Butte Dump. The people of English Creek dance to a square dance call from out of those files. They remember great cattle roundups recounted therein. They enjoy at their 4th of July picnic the succulent small spring frying chickens menued there. And yes, in my acknowledgments, I sing out a credit to the Montana Writers Project of the WPA era and to Merrill Burlingame. I mentioned earlier that obscure voices are often the most valuable ones to me in a library. There's another sort of library voice that I don't even know what to call, except maybe ventriloquism. I have this example. Now, like the rescued Montana Writers Project records, we are in Bozeman on a fine blue June day in 1977, when the five mountain ranges around the Gallatin Valley all stand up into the sky. In the MSU Library's archives, I'm going through a box of payroll records of the Dogie Ranch, where my father worked for several years as a ranch hand and eventually foreman, and where my mother was the cook during lambing seasons. I find their names on the payroll records, and other names as well. One I recognize dimly, an old man who is now the swamper, a guy who sweeps the floor, the grocery store in my hometown of White Sulphur Springs. The next day, too, is bright blue, and I'm talking to the old man, Tony Hunault, in his dark bachelor room above a bar in White Sulphur Springs. Yeah, Tony tells me in his Missourian voice. Knowed your daddy since I landed in this country in 1936 at shearing time at the Dogie. He staked me for my bedroll. I was so dead busted. Didn't have to do it neither, but he done her. And even though Tony Hunault is dead by the time this House of Sky is published the next year, those words of his speak in its pages. Tony had told me, too, that I ought to talk to so-and-so about some ranch topic. He knows A to Y about that. And that line speaks in the pages of English Crick. And Tony had said to me about another man he and my father worked with there on the Dogie. He was an SOB on six wheels. And that line is sure to speak in the pages of some future book of mine. There is simply no telling how long Tony Hunault will go on speaking in my pages by way of library ventriloquism. Speaking of speaking. Last month I participated in the symposium in tribute to Wallace Stegner at the University of Montana up in Missoula. Stegner's fatal car wreck in Santa Fe, as we all know, took from us the dean of American Western writers. It made me think back to last Christmas, when in my card to Stegner, I reported that I had a national bestseller, but it had taken Norman MacLean's fishing pole to get it, my reading of A River Runs Through It on the Audio Press cassette. And Stegner wrote back on his card, "Go on, keep on getting rich and famous and vocal." I suggested to the symposium gathering that maybe we can find a strength in this loss. That instead of Wallace Stegner's long familiar and often lonely eloquence for the West, the rest of the country may now have to hear from us as a tribe of Western writers, a swarm of us, an entire bunch of Western wordsmiths, heart earthers, various in our poetry and even our facts, but consistent in our love and expression for this region, these mountains, these plains. I'm reminded of what another writer, who lived and worked far from the supposed literary centers of the world, once said about what he hoped was the worth of his own writing. He was an African novelist named Kamara Leah, born in Guinea. He lived the last part of his life in exile in Senegal, where he died in 1980. Kamara Leah once told an interviewer who was asking how it was to work so far away from other writers from the literary power centers, the New Yorks, the Londons, the Parises. And Leah told him he thought the cultures of the world, as expressed in their writers, we're all participating in one vast dance, each with its own special movement, each contributing something significant to the total world rhythm. I can hear that in our own Western pages. The jukebox saloon tunes in the background of the prose of William Kittredge and James Crumley. The kitchen sung songs wafting out as the work of Barbara Kingsolver and Terry Tempest Williams. The anthems of small places and family niches in the writings of Mary Clearman Blue and Craig Leslie and Teresa Jordan. The tribal rhythms of the reservation behind the words of James Welch and Michael Doris and Louise Erdrich. The poetic balladry under Rudolfo Anaya's words and Norman MacLean's words and Wallace Stegner's words, and I hope maybe my own. If we are doing them right, they are something more than words. They are heartbeats of the West.